damn it! My life has value!
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here's a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
And welcome to UF Tredemy, everyone. UF Tredemy Radio, everyone. Tonight is... What is tonight? Tonight is March the 6th, 2011, and we're going to take two here. We had a little problem with our repeaters in the beginning, so we had to reboot it up. Got to love technology and auto updates that mess up your system. So we're going to try it again. Welcome to the show, everyone. We've got a great show lined up for you. It's going to be the first in a series that we're a new series that we're starting. It is called Gorillas in the Midst. We will be discussing asymmetrical warfare. We will be discussing guerrilla warfare. We will be discussing the theory and academical and hypothetical study of it. I do want to preface this show and this series before we even begin. I do not want anybody to construe this as any kind of an attack or affront against the U.S. government. Again, this is purely hypothetical, theoretical, and academic in the study of the book that Joseph P. Martino has written over the last 10 years called Resistance to Tyranny. We're going to start beginning to look at how an inferior force could possibly stand against a superior force. And in fact, if you look at the banner on the actual ad there, let me get to the actual banner, and we can cover what that says real quick. It's a saying from Sun Tzu. And give me one second, my computer is running a little bit slow. But it says, all warfare is based on deception, hence, when able to attack, we must seem unable. When using our forces, we must seem inactive. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe that we are far away. When far away, we must make him believe we are near. Hold out baits to entice your enemy, feign disorder, and crush him. Sun Tzu, The Art of War. That's what we're going to be discussing in this whole series that we're doing now. We've got some great... I got some great people lined up to be coming on here, and we're going to kick it off with the first guest, who's going to be basically walking us through the foundation fundamentals and a little bit different aspect of asymmetrical warfare than what many of you might be thinking about. I know that there's a lot of manuals that everybody downloads, Rangers, Green Beret, this, that, so forth and so on, and we're not going to be talking about those at all. This is going to be a foray into a different type of guerrilla warfare. And we'll be explaining to you why as well. So, with that being said, welcome to the show, Cavscat. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fantastic.
I'm glad to hear that. I've been excited about this show. I've been excited about this show now for about a week and a half, 2 weeks.
Well, yeah, actually, I've been excited about doing this show since I talked to you about maybe a month and a half ago. I'm glad to have the opportunity to reach an audience here and share the things that I've learned and things that I've seen firsthand in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, if there's nothing else to your intro, how about if I just get started?
Yeah, go ahead and get started. Actually, you know what? Hang on a second. We got somebody on the line from 617 real quick. Let's find out if they're just a listener listening in or if they're somebody with a question already.
All right.
So I'll go ahead and bring them on real quick, and we can take that, and we'll go from there.
Okay.
Yes, sir. My name is Jeff, calling from Chelsea, Massachusetts. How's it going?
Good. How are you doing, Jeff? How's the day treating you today?
It's treating me all right. I have to be at work early, so I'm glad you're taking my call. Now, as far as survival is concerned, I mean, and this is kind of a weird question, but I do security work for a living, and
okay,
and as far as jobs is concerned, I mean, I really believe the rug is going to be pulled out in the economy, and what are good jobs for a third world economy? Would security at a hospital be one of the jobs that would be viable in a third world economy? Right now, I currently work for an insurance company, and I plan on getting out of that very, very soon. And you were talking about manuals. I have manuals that I purchased at a bookstore for 25% off. Hawk's Green Beret Survival Manual, SAS Survival Guide, How to Survive Anything, Anywhere. No Second Chance Self Reality Based Guide to Self Defense, and Bug Out.
And you got a whole list of them there.
And I'm definitely gonna be reading those books and try and make use out of the knowledge that I get out of them. And I do have a mountain bike and I'm prepared somewhat, but that's just my main question. Occupations for the future when the rug gets completely pulled out of the economy, and any other kind of occupational suggestions you guys might have.
I have a suggestion for you. In fact, I have a very good suggestion for you. Sure. It's not going to be the answer you're looking for, though. When the rug is pulled out from under us, there is a plan. There is a plan that our founding fathers laid for us long, long ago that people are beginning to implement now. When government becomes destructive to its means, the founding fathers gave us the solutions. We have a civil authority, the committees of safety, and we have the militia. Now, we put together 11 shows that went through what the plan that the founding fathers laid out that has been modified for a modern theater. When that rug is pulled out, you're not going to be worrying about a job. You better be worrying about, you know, trying to take back your country, and it's not going to happen out in the woods in a bug out situation either. So my recommendation and suggestion to you would be to go back and listen to the downloads that we have of Time for a Plan, as well as the three audios or four audios that we've done, so the four broadcasts that we've done dealing with committees of safety. And if you look over to the right on the chat room, you'll also see another one called Tar and Feather. I would begin listening
to those.
Because the economy is still going to be there. We're still going to have, you know, but it's going to be a different situation than what you're thinking about. And until you really take a look at what we're discussing, you're not really going to understand what my answer would be to you then. So, yes, you will have a job. If you choose to stand and defend your country and your freedom, you will have a job. It will not only be a militia or a committee of safety or some other route along that, but it'll be in the community as well. So, but I would go back and listen to those audios, and if there's anybody listening, if they could help out here, maybe post some links to some of these audios that we mentioned, that would be helpful. I hope that answers your hand. I hope I can. That's about as good of an answer as I can give you with this limited amount of time.
No, before I go, you did a very good job, and the reason why I threw out security is security will be a very valuable thing in the future, because in third world countries, when you can't get the country back, people do have to survive. Trade, barter, just farming, heavy lifting, which I can do, anything like that, people do have to survive, and that's why I threw that out there.
I agree with you there as well. You know, when you go back and you listen to the shows, like, you'll find out. Basically, let me put to you the premise of the plan. The premise of the plan basically is what the founding fathers did. They created committees of safety to handle the government infrastructure. The militia were subordinate to them. Now, the committees of safety, basically what they did is they took control of small areas where they ensured that their freedom was going to stay. That's where they made their stands at, and from there they grew out.
Wow.
Now, let's say we take over. Let's say that you're in a small rural area and martial law is declared and your local people say no. You're now going to take that town and hold the resources there, including agricultural, manufacturing, and all that stuff. So will you be working? Oh, yeah. If you engage in the plan. If not, well, then I don't know what you're going to do.
Also, I forgot to say this. I live in a very third world area that's Hispanic, and most of the people have no loyalty to this country. I mean, I live in a hardcore urban area, so that's So basically, you're going to have the East Coast, which is for the most part finished because it's mostly these third world enclaves, and so forth. So I do have to get out of the third world area, but I figured I'd throw that out there to you. Yep. I thank you for having me on the broadcast, and do have a good one.
All right, you take care. You have a great one. All right, well, there we go. Well, we got dial tone. We got dial tone. All right, well, listen, everybody, we are now going to get back to this, and we'll go from there. So let us talk about asymmetrical warfare. Take us where you're going to take us.
All right. I'd have to start off by saying, and you kind of touched on it earlier, that a lot of the folks they think they're getting ready for asymmetrical warfare by reading field manuals. The problem with reading a field manual is that it was written by someone else, and now that you've read this manual, you know exactly what they know, and you're pretty much going to be acting the way you'd expect, or they would be expecting you to act. That's the big problem there. You actually wind up putting yourself in a tactical box, basically.
Oh, you are so right about that. Unpredictability is an important aspect of this.
That it is. And the problem with Western armies, and actually the army that I would like to talk about is as to now unknown but very ominous Super Ninja Robot Zombie Nazi army that will be knocking on our doors pretty soon. But anyways, you know, just to keep it strange.
You gotta love the Super Ninja Robot Zombie Nazis, man. I mean, they could be lethal in the future. You gotta watch them bastards. We gotta start prepping for them now. So, hence the reason for this show.
Absolutely.
We are not gonna be puttery.
No. The problem with Western armies is that they're over reliant on technology, and that absolutely limits the infantry. It really does. Individual infantry tactics are basically non-existent in modern armies, and that is a skill that needs to be revived, basically. And with these individual infantry tactics, a force that isn't as well armed as these invading zombie Nazis can actually engage and win, you know, win not necessarily in pitch battles, but they would be able to outmaneuver, outthink, and outreact an enemy that only knows one way of doing things. That being said, I'd like to introduce you guys to what was coined by the Chinese as mobile warfare. What mobile warfare is not staying in one area. The American mindset is to get entrenched, you know, I'm going to defend this spot till I die, and, you know, you build up your freaking sandbags, and, you know, you get your little sniper perch in your house or whatever, and you're ready to defend your house until the end. Well, all you've done is you've wasted your life, you've just handed over your leftover ammunition to the enemy, and all that time that you went, you know, that went into preparing just went for naught because you've just wasted everything by staying in a static position. Mobile warfare is completely opposite to the way that the average American thinks. You're going to have your strong positions that you have to build basically from scratch. You're going to have caches from one point to another, and what you do in mobile warfare is when you get attacked, you engage the enemy. When, you know, when shit gets too heavy, you move to your next position and you, you know, you rearm, you refit and you fight again. And if, when that shit gets too heavy, you move to another position, or you might move back to your original position. Constantly moving, not necessarily falling back, moving in a circle, fall back if you have to, move forward when you can, attack, defend. It is not, the whole idea is not to stay still for very long. You take your shots when you can. And hopefully as these shows progress, I would like to start sharing, you know, what are the a good target, because shooting a zombie Nazi gunner on an armored vehicle isn't always the best target. I'll get to that later. The biggest thing that is required to make mobile warfare a success is what I call area prep. That means, you know, that's all the shit that's not sexy, the stuff that they never show in movies, or the stuff that they'll show in a montage in a movie, because it's just not sexy. It's long, boring, it's hard work, it's sweaty, it's not something that's fun to do. It requires some hard work. A lot of times it'll require a shovel. Dig trenches, dig tunnels, drill holes. Something where you can shoot from where someone wouldn't expect you to be shooting from. You know, these things are called murder holes. You can have one ready in the middle of a wall or down closer to the bottom. One of the things that I noticed in Iraq, when a team comes in to clear a house, there were holes knocked out on the second floor. What those holes were for is as soon as a force comes in, they would drop grenades on top of you. That right there is three-dimensional thinking. You know, it's not just I'm at the window and I'm shooting down and then, you know, when they come in the house, well, then I'll run over to the staircase and I'll stop them there. No, that's attacking from down up and from up down with the tunnels and murder holes down closer to the bottom of the house. I'd really like to get people to start thinking, you know, three-dimensionally. Again, talking to people, it's all about, you know, hey, setting up snipers and I'm going to shoot and then I'm going to, you know, shoot and scoot. Okay, great. You know, that can only go so far. Eventually, you're going to get pinned down, or at least the enemy is going to think they have you pinned down. You need to have your area of egress set up so that where you run to is just as strong or even stronger from where you ran from. But that's basically the introduction. That's kind of like just scratching the surface.
You know, if you don't mind, if I could jump in here for a second, I was recently, you know,
hey, go ahead,
I've read all the manuals, you know, I've read the sniper manuals and all that other good stuff, you know, from all these people, you know, all the militaries that are put out there. And then I actually talked with a real sniper, and I was reading another website that deals specifically with urban sniping, the historical aspects of it. And I find that what the manuals teach and what actually worked are two different things. For instance, you know, when you think of, you know, like in all the movies, you see the movies, you know, with that bad guy sniper or the good guy sniper, depending on the movie role, you know, the resistance fighter during the French Revolution, whatever. You see mm-hmm. them up in these buildings, you know, down a one, you know, down a narrow, you know, they're sitting at the end of a narrow street with a, you know, clear line of sight up at the highest level of the building, and they're just pumping ammo out. They're taking out the enemy. According to the snipers that I talked to, and, you know, like this website in particular, they were saying that is the worst thing you could be, and that's the worst position a sniper could be in.
Mm-hmm.
So all the, you know, a lot of these things that we're told are true and that we think are true are really not true. You know, he was saying that the most effective sniper is a sniper who has a die in his pocket, you know, like a dice, a six-sided dice.
Yeah.
And he basically rolls that dice to determine position, north, south, east, west, northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest, to determine his position for a local area. That way everything is completely random and there is no predetermined spot, as well as staying pretty much ground level because you have egress and escape routes open to you then, and you can't be trapped in that building. Which is something that you had talked about when we were talking about earlier. You had mentioned that there was a sniper encounter that your squad, your platoon, had encountered a sniper, and you thought he was inside the building. Because that's where you automatically assume that they are. But he wasn't.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. He was actually firing from on top of the building. We didn't know that there was a kind of like a makeshift fire escape behind the building. There were open windows there, and the guys in my platoon ran into the building to clear out the building. All they found was a security guard that they were getting ready to shoot, and then the owner of the building. My job was to secure the outside, and that's how I found the fire escape. Looking down an alleyway, I noticed a group of people celebrating. I could tell that the sniper was within that group, and they were just, they were having a blast. And we were just a few hundred meters away from them, and they were so confident that we weren't going to pursue them that they were already celebrating, and they were absolutely right. My platoon sergeant said, under no circumstances are we going to go and leave this secure area. They were just, basically they were just too scared to move, or either that or just stuck inside a mental box. The sniper, best weapon isn't always stealth, like, you see on the History Channel or the military channel. From my personal experience, a sniper's best weapon is mobility. A sniper doesn't always have to wear a freaking ghillie suit, okay? If I'm dressed in civilian clothes and I take a shot, drop my rifle, and take off and mingle in with the crowd, how the hell are you going to know, I'm moving from point A to point B, take my other shot with the rifle that I've already had set aside. From my personal experience, getting shot at by snipers and going to where they shot from, that's mobility is the key. Stealth has its place. But from what I saw, when your enemy isn't there for you to attack, it's extremely frustrating. That goes into another aspect of guerrilla warfare where your job is to frustrate the enemy, not necessarily to kill the enemy. That can come later. But if you can get into his mind, if you can frustrate him, what's the word I'm looking for? It's when you're just...
Psychological warfare, basically.
Yeah, it's psychological warfare, but...
They become a lot more ineffective when they're on tilt because you've been coming at them at so many angles they don't understand, and it's like you're a ghost.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you fight that? Their manuals don't teach them how to deal with that.
Oh, hell no. No, absolutely not. When you get hit by an IED and, you're looking for somebody to shoot and there's nobody there to shoot, after a while that affects you, and you pretty much become an ineffective soldier. One of two ways. Either you're going to shut down or you're going to start killing everything around you, including civilians and people that had nothing to do with it. And either one of those outcomes works towards the insurgents' favor. Because the people are going to turn against you and start favoring the insurgents. I'd like to start introducing the people here to what I've been reading on what basically is a fundamental or the foundation, actually, of guerrilla warfare. If the I'd say have to say that the best example we've got of guerrilla warfare that, you know, that we as a nation have encountered would be the Viet Cong. I mean, these guys had it down pat. Their techniques were derived from a collection of works called the 36 Stratagems. Each one is basically it's a saying that has a deeper meaning. I've got a few of them, a few of the ones that would apply to our Super Ninja Robot Zombie Nazi problem. I'd like to share and explain them with the audience. The first one being, like I said, these are a collection of sayings. I'm sure it sounds very poetic in Chinese, but here it is in English. The first one is, deceive the heavens to cross the ocean. What this is basically you disguise movement with movement, or you disguise one thing with something else that the enemy is used to seeing. For example, if you need to move your group from point A to point B, and we saw this a lot, you hide amongst the crowd. You know, you don't set up a convoy with security vehicles and all that, and you go from point A to point B. That attracts way too much attention. You're just going to wind up getting ambushed. No, you join a crowd of refugees or what we saw in Iraq, pilgrims going from one point of the country to another. You know, no security checkpoint is going to check every single one of those people. And that's how insurgents moved a lot of the times when they wanted to move big groups of people. That's how they did it. They worked on a different timetable than a regular army would. They took opportunities as they came. They didn't move when they felt they wanted to. They moved when they could.
Okay. Again, that goes back to that hiding in plain sight, though, like what you were talking about with your, you know, with the sniper reference. So you hide in plain sight.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Another thing, I've seen videos of snipers in Iraq, and they're shooting from a car. You know, they'll find a platoon out there doing, or some, you know, a group out on patrol. They'll park. They'll take a shot. And they roll out. Cars is something that the soldier was used to seeing. One car parked across the street or down the road, it really didn't, you know, is something that wouldn't be noticed. I'd have to say that you said it, hide in plain sight. The American equivalent to this would be, you know, the best place to hide a tree is in a forest. If you have this as in the back of your mind, and you do all of your actions based on things like this, there's no way that the enemy is going to be able to predict where you are or where you're coming from, because everything you do is something that he has already seen before. As in, like, there's a car parked across the street. Well, hell, as long as I've been here, that car has been parked across the street. You know, we've inspected the car 10 times already, and we haven't found anything. Well, guess what? The 11th time that you approach the car, there's a bomb in there. That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Get the enemy used to seeing something. Get them used to seeing a particular action or a particular group of people. Once they've gotten used to that, that's when you can attack.
Well, I agree. Actually, you know what? When you talked on that for a moment, and you know, that human nature is there as well. When you've done something repetitiously, you begin to get bored with it, and you stop doing it as methodically as you normally would. Like, you've seen that car 50 times, you've checked that car 50 times. Mm-hmm. That car in your mind registers as a non-threat anymore. So then you become to lax. You become to get lazy. You become lax, and that is human nature.
Exactly. And I'll have to admit, you know, we were guilty of the same thing. You know, we saw the same group of people, the same taxi cab with the same driver driving past 20, 30 times, you know, over a month. You know, the next month, all of a sudden, holy crap, the guy's a damn car bomber. You know, we never thought, for example, perfect example, there's one guy on our very first patrol. We went through this one little village. This guy comes out with a tray full of Pepsis, and he's, you know, hanging out with us, and he introduced us to his family and his baby. And every time we passed through this village, the guy was out there. He loved American music, and the guy would entertain us with dancing like Michael Jackson. But it turns out the guy was an insurgent. He was just getting to know us, trying to find out what our weaknesses was, and you know, he tried his hand at taking us out. Fortunately for us, it didn't work out for him. But we were actually very surprised that we were getting played like that the whole time. But anyway, let me move to my next point. The next one here is it's two different cities, and if you've ever read the Art of War, you're familiar with this story. It's called Besiege Wei to Rescue Zhao. And what this means is, let's say that your buddy down the street is he's getting raided by the zombie Nazis. Well, you can either run and help him and, you know, encounter this big force of zombie Nazis that are just going to, you know, wipe you out. Or you could hit the zombie Nazi base or, the you know, their headquarters or where they launched this raid from. You do that, well, the zombie Nazis, or at least a portion of them, are probably going to break away from your buddy's house to go, you know, rescue their buddies back on base.
Right.
Once that force is split, that's when your other team goes in and hits the remaining zombie Nazis to rescue your buddy. That is a technique that I believe you can use over and over again, because the enemy is never really going to be sure where you're going to hit. You can hit the base, you can hit their buddy's base, you can hit their combo relay station, or whatever it is. Anything that they find valuable, that is where you strike first.
When we look at that, when we're looking at targets like, you know, when we're looking at situations like that, you brought up a great point there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't know how strong, you know, like these, you know, robot Nazis, you know, these super ninja robot zombie Nazis.
There you
they
go.
Wouldn't, you know, they really wouldn't be sure just how strong or how effective an attack is going on at the base. So if you did attack that, they would have to start splitting forces up then to cover the areas. And like you mentioned, you could do that time and time again, because they have to be sure that those areas are secure.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. The one thing that Sun Tzu said, no enemy can be in all places or can be strong in all places all the time. They have to be weak one in one area or another, or in all places. Any enemy that divides and subdivides his forces to make sure that every area of approach is covered is weak in all of those places. And, hell, that's one of the things that we need to take into account when figuring out the best way to hit robot zombie Nazis. A big show of force or a big frontal attack, that's hardly ever going to work. Waiting for an ambush, well, if you have, let's say, First Street, you know, set up for an ambush. Well, what if they don't go down that road? What if they go somewhere else? What if they stay there? You know, I just really want to get the audience to start thinking of different ways to attack, to start seeing different targets. If I can get a few people change that way tonight, I'll be happy as hell.
Well, you know, you're right. In fact, you know, you would mention that before, and I'd like to reiterate that. You know, if these robots, super robot or super ninja, what is it again? Super ninja?
Super ninja robot zombie Nazis, man. Get it right. It's the enemy.
Super ninja robot zombie Nazis. All right, but I got to keep. I got to get that straight.
Yeah.
You know, if we use the exact same tactics that they're trained in against them, and they outnumber us, and they outnumber, you know, let's say they outnumber an inferior force.
Uh-huh.
And that inferior force is trying to use those exact same tactics that that group, you know, that the Nazis are, that those zombie Nazis are using. One, they have more people, so they're going to be able to, they have more resources. They'll be able to last longer. Attrition is a son of a bitch.
Yeah.
You've got the exact same tactics, which means they're going to be able to outthink you because they know what you're doing. And again, they have more manpower, more resources. You're going to be playing a losing game there, and the numbers of attrition and the laws of attrition are going to be against the inferior force.
Absolutely.
So you don't want to use the super ninja robot zombie Nazis, you know, manuals,
tactics.
You know, tactics,
yeah,
against them. It's going to be a losing battle there. We got to start, you would have to start thinking of other ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. I mean, anyone who is taking a field manual and thinking that they're training with this manual, or they think that because they're training with this manual, they're going to be able to handle the enemy, they are completely wrong. Because the enemy has used these manuals, and they're training with them day in and day out, and they're going to be better at it than you are. They've got more ammunition than you have. They've got more manpower, armored vehicles. They're going to be able to do to do what you can't do, and you're trying to match them, you know, basically, you know, technique for technique. It's the same thing that happened with us during the Revolutionary War. You know, we tried to get in line and fight it out with the British the same way that they did, and we got our asses handed to us. One of the most successful battles we had was the very first one, the one that started off the Revolution. Let's see if I get this date right. April 17th, 1775, mm-hmm, I believe, was Lexington.
Lexington and Concord.
Exactly, Lexington and Concord. And
well, wasn't it the 19th?
The 19th? Sorry, I got the day wrong.
Yeah, I think it was April 19th. Anybody in the chat room can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Yeah.
I stopped worrying about dates myself, so I'm just worried about the events. I don't care about the dates they happen myself. Dates just take too much time.
The British were lined up. You know, they were fighting the way they're used to, and the militias were actually using a mobile offense where they would line up on either side of the road. They'd fire a volley into these guys. They'd fall out, go farther down the road, and wait an ambush for the British, you know, with the remaining British to move towards them. And they would fire and not stay there very long. They would move, set up another spot, fire again. That was one of the most successful battles we ever had. And that was because the people in charge were making decisions on the fly, and we were fighting in a manner that the enemy did not expect and did not have a defense for. But as soon as we learned to fight like the British did, that's when we started getting our asses kicked, until we figured out, holy hell, you know, this ain't working. We need to, you know, fight more like the Indians do. But you're absolutely right. If you try to learn what the enemy knows and then think that that's going to be enough for you to use it against him, you are sadly mistaken, because you're going to get your ass handed to you time and time again. You need to outthink the enemy, you need to outprepare the enemy, and you need to fight in a manner that the enemy does not expect you to fight. April 19th, 1775.
There you go, that's April 19th, 1775.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty. Another one, point three. Now, I don't know if you had anything else to say about the other two.
Nope, we're good. I'm good to go there.
All right, cool.
Oh, real quick, let me throw in here. If anybody's got any questions, comments, there's a couple ways that you can get in here with us. You can either call in. The toll-free line is 877-374-3980. Or you could drop your name. If you have Skype, you can drop your Skype ID name in the chat room, and I'll bring you onto the call with us, and you can post your comments, questions that way. Please try to keep it relevant to the conversation at hand, and let's not go off into other tangents, and that's about it. So, or you could just post your questions in the chat room, and I can read them off there, but keep in mind that if you post them in the chat room, and everybody else is posting questions at the same time, they might get lost. So, other than that, continue on.
Okay. The next one is one that I talked to you about a little while ago. I'll give you the same example I gave you. If I was to, to pull the average American off the street and say, "Hey, man, listen, I got an idea for you. We're going to break into that house." The one thing, or I believe that the one thing that they would do is think, "Okay, great. Well, we're gonna hit the house when the owner's not there, and we're gonna, use some special tools to break inside the house, or use some type of tool to break inside the house. Maybe, some way to render their security system, useless. Figure out some sneaky way to get in there." Well, that's the average way that a person thinks about breaking into a house. Well, I say completely change that. The next saying is loot a burning house. What that means is if you want the easiest way to get into that house, set the house on fire, and you'll see that really quickly the owner of that house is going to open the door and let you right in, if he believes that you're there to help him. But either way, he's still going to let you in, and that would be the easiest way to get into the house. The way that would apply to a combat situation is to attack when the enemy is weakest. And you can do that by waiting for an opportunity or create the opportunity. And as a side note, I believe that the zombie Nazis all around us in this world are actually creating opportunities in this country. They're basically, I believe, setting this country on fire, and they're getting ready to loot this burning house. That's my personal belief. I don't know what you guys believe, but hey,
I think. You. I agree with you, man. These damn Nazis, zombie Nazis, man. You can't trust them one bit. I mean, they're coming. I've been saying since the end of World War II, man. You know, all those dead Nazis that were on the ground, they're all going to rise up one day and come get us. So.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're here. I think they're coming soon. And hey, I think all the predictive programming with all the zombie movies that are coming out too really play that. I mean, I think it reinforces that. I think they're trying to tell us something.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question now. That whole concept of loot a burning home.
Uh huh.
Now, Sun Tzu was very Sun Tzu was just one of the greatest scholars when it comes to warfare, whether it was traditional warfare or asymmetrical. Now, we don't have to take everything so literally. Loot a burning home. It doesn't necessarily mean you got to burn the place down.
No. I'm just using that as an example.
Well, I'm saying to get that picture out there to everybody else. You can create a situation where the person that is in that building, that home, that whatever, they feel the need to flee. Because
exactly.
Something that is eminently dangerous to them. Mm-hmm. It could be, like you said, a fire. It could be anything. But the point is to get them to get out of that house, out that door, away from the home, and to leave that door unlocked for you.
Yeah.
Especially like, supply depots, things like that. You want them coming out. There was a great scene in a movie that I saw. I don't agree with the things, but there was a movie called Colors. It came out a long time ago. It was about gangs in South Central L.A.,
mm-hmm.
And you can see that you can see them applying that tactic. What they did is, they threw a grenade into a home, a rundown gang house, where all the gang members were hanging out. Bunch of Bloods came, or the Mexicans came. They threw a grenade in there. Everybody comes running out, and they come running out into an ambush.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of those guys going in there trying to clear that building and ending up in a worse environment than having everybody rush out to them.
Yeah. They took the strength away from the enemy. That's actually one of the other points. But no, that was perfectly. They created a situation where the enemy wanted to get out of the house and wind up wound up exposing themselves to enemy fire. And that's perfect. It doesn't necessarily have to apply to a home or a building. It can apply to an armored vehicle. You get the people out of the armored vehicle, and then the armored vehicle is yours. Or whatever, you know, or basically whatever it is. If you create the situation to get the enemy to leave the position that they hold now. That's basically the point of the technique.
Real quick though, you had brought up that point about the armored vehicle. Would you mind going into that a little bit? You know, let's play that same scenario. Wow, you got an armored vehicle here. You had mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. you know, like with the are you going to go? You know, when you were talking about, you know, the turret gunner, or yeah. I mean, you know, like somebody, you know, on the back of the 50 or something like that. They're, you know, that are somewhat protected. They're somewhat enclosed. How would you go about, you know, trying to get these guys out of those old Panzer tanks? Or, you know, let's say they got rid of the Panzers and they're more and more modern vehicles, because they probably are now. I mean, they probably took over stuff. They, you know, they've been looting along the way as they're rising up in power. So now they've got modern vehicles. How do you get them out of a modern armored personnel carrier?
Well, one of two things. We could get them out, or you could just get the vehicle to leave. I want to touch on that one, and I know what you're getting at, and that actually goes into my very next point. But let me go back here and say that you don't always have to attack the gunner or basically destroy the vehicle. Sometimes just destroying something like, let's say, their communication. I've seen modern armored vehicles with, and believe this or not, the wiring is external, which I found really, really strange because, you know, in a good firefight, all that COMO wire and all that GPS wiring would get trashed. Hey, well, you know, I didn't design the vehicle, so, I was just a gunner there, man. Forget that. but if you destroy their communication, like, for example, the base of the antenna on a Humvee was about the size of a foam cup, one of the large foam cups, and actually about around the same shape. If you were to put a round in that, that would basically destroy the antenna. If that vehicle doesn't have commo with the rest of the platoon, they're probably, that whole operation is probably just going to turn around, go back to base to get it fixed. Sometimes that's all you want. You know, you just want to buy yourself a little time to do whatever it is that you had to do. You don't always want to start a battle. If you take out the gunner, you're going to have a firefight in your hands. If you take out the radio, what are they going to do? They're going to go out, find out where the hell that shot came from. They're going to be happy nobody got hurt, and they're going to laugh it off and go back to base.
Mm-hmm.
Never are they going to realize that that was your intention the entire time. Now, back to a way to get people out of the armored vehicle. All right, my next point, this one is called, and it's kind of weird, going into that the whole zombie thing, this one is called borrow a corpse to resurrect the soul. What this is reviving old technology, things that people think are outdated, things that they no longer have a defense against. The best example of this for anybody out there that saw the movie The Last Castle, where the old general that was in the jail, in the military jail, tested the warden's defense by starting a little riot, and he was able to see everything that the warden had, you know, basically as a defense. What this general then did is he revived old Roman technology with a ballista, the type of catapult, and basically shields. That the shields were defense against a water cannon, and the ballista is what they used to take out the warden's office. A technology that I would propose to take out a zombie Nazi armored vehicle would be a flamethrower. That's something that we don't have a defense against, or the zombie Nazis don't have a defense against. If you set a vehicle on fire, let's say, for example, you have yourself a little Molotov cocktail. One Molotov cocktail. What are you going to do? Are you going to try to hit the gunner? No. You're probably going to wind up missing anyways. Or you're going to hit the turret shield and, you know, okay, great, the turret's on fire, but you didn't do a damn thing. The vehicle is still going to be rolling. I would say instead of trying to hit something like that, hit the tire. Get the tire on fire. The front end of the average armored vehicle is actually made out of fiberglass. And the tires will, you know, I mean, hell, once you get those things on fire, it's almost impossible to get them to turn off or to, you know, to put out. That tire will catch the engine. And then, you know, hey, very quickly, the people inside that vehicle are going to have to make a decision, either stay in there and burn up or get the hell out. Either way, you know, you've got the same outcome. You've got dead zombie Nazis or re-dead zombie Nazis. Another thing is I know this from personal experience. Once a Humvee catches on fire, that damn thing is going to burn down to ashes. I was really, really surprised. One of our Humvees got hit, and that's basically what happened. The tire caught on fire. The vehicle behind it, our SOP was if the vehicle, you know, was still in the kill zone and wasn't able to get out, the vehicle behind him would basically push that vehicle in front out of the kill zone. Well, by the time we were able to push that vehicle out of the kill zone, the second vehicle caught on fire. Well, both those vehicles burned to the ground. And there we were, two vehicles short, with casualties, out in the open, with really nothing to hide behind or to defend against. Had we been ambushed at that time, I am sure that our entire platoon would have been wiped out. Just something for you guys to think about. Now, did you have anything to, or any question on that one, Randy?
No, not that I can see. But no, you're very true. You're very right there. I mean, no matter what, though, it's like what somebody had mentioned in there. We had talked about this yesterday. Water takes the path of least resistance. Why attack the most hardened position? Attack the weakest area of it. You know, find that weak link. You know, I mean, if you're Nazi zombies, you know, if they can't walk, if they need two legs to walk, you know, take off a leg. And then they can't walk anymore. Now they're stuck to crawling, you know. There's other ways to handle this, you know, to achieve a goal than the hardest way in or the hardest way out. I mean, there's other ways around it. Mm-hmm. And you would also mention something about having multiple objectives as well. For instance,
I'll get to that later.
All right, going to get to that one later.
I mean, if you want me to go into that right now.
No, you got your out. No, you got your thing. You go. I'm just kind of here for the ride, so you go along with it.
Okay, cool. Now, you touched on something. Find out where their weak point is and attack that weak point. Well, I say this. Instead of waiting for the zombie Nazis to show up to find out their weak point, why don't you talk to people who have experience dealing with these zombie Nazis and find out what their weak points are beforehand and set up your techniques accordingly. Don't wait for the attack to happen for you to then to start preparing. Prepare now. Plan out now. Find out what the weak points are now. Practice your attacks against these weak points. For example, the one thing that I would love to do is for my sharpshooters. Like I said, the base of an antenna is the same size as a large foam cup. Set a foam cup out at a certain distance and see, you know, practice shooting that target, you know, a target of that size and shape. That way, you know, two things. My sharpshooter is getting, you know, good training, and I'm already programming them to hit that target. Because like I said earlier, it's not always going to be a kill shot. You don't always need to fire a kill shot. You just need something to deter the enemy, or something to sometimes all you want is the enemy to move towards you or to move away from you, depending on the situation. It doesn't always have to be a kill shot. Alrighty. Now, taking advantage of opportunities is the next point. The next saying is, it's kind of silly. Take the opportunity to pilfer a goat.
Right.
With that,
pilfer a goat. We're going to
pilfer
goats.
Goat. Exactly. What that means is never miss an opportunity to take advantage of an opportunity. If you see an opening for anything, like let's say you're just driving down the road and you see a zombie Nazi with his pants down, take a shot. You know, hell, you know, it's an impromptu thing, or, you know, but it'll work. Or if you've got an opportunity, you know, say a zombie Nazi is asleep behind the wheel with his window open, drop a grenade inside his, or drop a grenade on his lap. You know, something simple like that. Never miss an opportunity to do something, or never miss an opportunity to steal something from the enemy, to take something away, whether it's personnel or equipment. Sometimes you can steal it, sometimes you have to destroy it, but either way, you deny the enemy equipment and personnel. And, you know, after doing that several hundred times, you know, the entire, a whole region of doing that, that's going to start costing the enemy, and they're going to have to start changing the way they do things. But that's that point. Never miss an opportunity to relieve the enemy of something that they hold valuable. Let's see. Next point after that, remove the firewood from under the pot. If something must be destroyed, destroy the source of their power, basically, or whatever. An example I have is to destroy, like, zombie Nazi vehicles. They're not solar-powered. They run on fuel. If you see an opportunity to hit a fuel truck, hit the fuel truck. Hit the food supplies. Hit a power station. Do whatever you can to destroy the enemy's source of energy. Whether it's, well, like I said, whether it's food or fuel or electricity. Again, it's, you know, things like that aren't necessarily sexy, but it would be necessary. Attacking a power station, that's something that the Taliban does time and time again. Those things are just frustrating. You know, they really, you know, you send a team in there to fix what they broke. You go out, you try to set up as much, you know, protection as possible. And then a couple of months later, they're going to hit it again. Then you have to go in there and fix it again. It's annoying, but it does get into the soldier's mind, because they get a feeling that no matter what they do, they're never going to be able to stop the insurgents from doing this.
You had mentioned in these aspects, you know, when we look at, in fact, any warfare, I mean, even look at the U.S. Army, when they go in, like when they invaded Baghdad or, you know, Iraq or any of these places, when they go into a city, what's the first things they go after are communications,
yep,
energy, water, food, and government facilities.
Yeah.
These are the exact same areas that you're talking about them going after, and they go after them for a reason. They're vital. They might not be sexy, but they're vital.
Yeah.
You can take it one step farther, even, and, you know, deliberately break stuff that they know they're going to have to come fix just to, you know, fuck off the people that are coming to fix it.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. You just deliberately break the stuff because you know they're going to come. And that, you know, I'll tell you what, I'll touch on that right now. That goes to what you were asking me to do earlier, and you set up a mission with more than one objective. If you break the shit, well, you know someone is going to come to fix it. Well, ambush those people. And you know that there's probably going to be a helicopter coming to rescue those people that you've just ambushed. Set up an ambush for that helicopter. Even if the two ambushes don't work out, you've still destroyed the power station. That's a win. If you damaged the power station but didn't fully destroy it, but one of your ambushes worked, that's definitely a win. One of the things that I'd like to do is that would be a good idea, is if you're going to ambush some vehicles, get in there, take what you can from those vehicles, take what you can from the personnel, and then get the hell out. You deny the enemy his equipment and personnel, and you've just resupplied yourself. Also, if you take out an enemy aircraft, you can never underestimate the power of a downed aircraft being broadcast, or the vision of a downed aircraft on national TV. I mean, that right there it's definitely an oh shit moment for the enemy when we start downing zombie aircraft. And it can be done. Hell, the freaking Somalis did it. And the Mujahideen did it many times to the Russians, and this was before we started supplying them with Stingers. But there is no reason why one mission should only have one objective. If a mission has more than one objective, more than one goal, you definitely broaden your chances of succeeding in one of those goals.
Absolutely, and you also can spread them out, ambush here, ambush there, get them fixing that, you can control where they're deploying their forces, mm-hmm. spread them away from other targets too. You hit them, left, right, up and down, and you just keep them on their toes.
Yep, and actually, you've just touched on my very next point. They call it disturb the water to catch the fish. what you're doing is you're causing a disturbance in one spot to open up an opportunity in another. Or you're causing disturbances in several locations so that the enemy can disperse his forces. And then, you have a weakened enemy to deal with. Well, for example, if I'm going to ambush something in downtown, I would send a small force to attack in the suburbs. When the zombie Nazis go to the suburbs to try to handle, that situation, that's when I hit downtown. Or if the same thing can be said with, or the same technique would apply if you use many small different forces all around your objective. Your enemy is going to take off in many different directions to try to handle to put out all these small firefights. And then you can go in and have to deal with a lightly defended area.
If you're really out of the box with what you're doing, you can make your small forces seem to be a lot larger than what they are. If you're really thinking outside of the box, it's a mm-hmm. misconception, it's a misdirect. If they think a large force is attacking, even though it's just a small stuff, a small squad making a whole bunch of noise, they're going to overestimate what the threat is, and exactly, they'll pull a whole bunch of forces off to go deal with just a few people, thinking it's something other than what it is.
That's absolutely correct. Zombie Nazis have a tendency, actually, to overreact, and they're going to be sending a whole lot of zombie Nazis to go deal with a very small group of people. That happens time and time again. And if they're, that small group of people can melt away into the surrounding population very easily. a whole lot easier than, you know, than a platoon size element, which would be, you know, between 20 and 30 people. But if you've got three or four guys, you know, making a whole lot of noise, blowing shit up, you know, firing off in random directions, as soon as the enemy comes in, these guys can melt away and, you know, never get spotted, opening up opportunities for the rest of your team to do things. Let's see. Okay. Here's another thing. I've got a list actually of just ideas. Things that I really want people to think about. Things that things that I've seen used in real life. But I would like for people to start training or working their way to being able to use these ideas, or hell, come up with your own idea. But here we go. I already touched on the one cutting holes in the floors to drop explosives in a team that comes to clear out a house. For example, let's say I'm held up in my house, okay, and you know, the zombie Nazi SWAT team comes in. Well, I'm gonna have holes set up in my floor. I'm gonna drop explosives in on these guys, where the, you know, where they think they've got control of an area. All they've done is they've put themselves in exactly where I want them to be. You know, now I can take them out with explosives. One other thing that, going back to area prep, if you've ever read my posting on the U-shaped ambushes, I definitely harp on this one a lot. If you know that you're going to have to fall out really fast and bug out the, you know, bug out from an area that, or from a fighting position, cut holes in fences or knock down a fence or do something. This is something that we saw in Iraq over and over again. These guys would shoot from a house and they'd get the hell out through holes that they knocked in a concrete wall. We'd think we'd had them trapped, and all they did was slow us down. You know, we'd go in there to clear the house. Well, hell, they already gone a long time ago. They fired three shots and got the hell out. I just see no reason why you should just fortify your fighting position and totally ignore your egress, totally ignore the way that you're going to escape. That actually should be your primary focus.
Okay.
Make sure when you set up a mission, your focus should be how the hell am I going to get out of here? You know.
And don't be shy about leaving booby traps behind.
Oh hell no! Absolutely not. No, that's definitely on my list. But I would first set up the find the spot that I could escape from. Find a fighting position, and then figure out what I can do from here. You know, find a place, and then set up the mission accordingly. Instead of figuring out what you want to hit, and then figuring out where you're going to hit from, and then lastly figuring out how the hell you're going to get out of Dodge. That is the ass-backwards way of doing things. As long as you can escape, you can always come back and fight again. Even if you took your three shots and completely missed, if you're not there, then you succeeded in frustrating the enemy. And that, in my book, is definitely a win. It pissed us to hell off every time we'd get shot at and we couldn't find out who the hell shot at us. You were saying something, Randy?
I was going to say, somebody had made a comment in the chat room as well, you know, about, you know, that, you know, getting a... if a call goes out for, you know, one of the, you know, super ninja robot zombie Nazi getting hit and man down or zombie down call will bring the other zombies to that area, leaving those areas that they just left unsecured now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, diversion. Control the flow of the engagement, actually, is what basically this whole thing comes down to. Controlling the flow of the engagement and making everybody else believe that your actual intention is something other than what it really is.
Yeah, I agree.
And again, like you had mentioned, you know, you got to keep your escape routes open. I mean, if you don't know how you're getting out, then you obviously weren't planning on leaving to begin with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. another thing is, I would use lookouts or scouts to secure these areas of egress or routes of egress. If plan A is to, you know, to go out the back of the house and then turn left and go through this fence, well, let's say that there's a group of zombie Nazis there. Well, you've got one guy outside of the house watching which way you're going to go. Well, he can tell you, hey, man, don't go this way. Go to plan B. That's another thing. You know, you need to have guys, spotters, that are not armed. You know, the only thing they have is a radio. They don't look offensive or dangerous in any way. Some people don't agree with my technique, but I use girls. I use teenage girls. Who the hell is going to suspect this, you know, a cute little teenage girl that she's actually working for the enemy? Old people are actually very good at this. You know, an old person held out in their house, you know, they come in to clear the house, all they see is this old guy on a freaking, you know, tank of oxygen, and they're like, okay, well, I understand why this guy is still here, and they take off. Meanwhile, this guy's looking out his window telling me exactly, you know, where the zombie Nazis are going to hit me next. Everyone in your group doesn't have to be a fighter. Everyone in your group doesn't have to be armed for every single mission. Knowledge and information is your best weapon against zombie Nazis. If your team, your fire team, knows where they're going to hit you from, they will never be able to score a hit. That's one of the things I would like to beat into everybody that I talk to. It's not the best way to beat the enemy isn't always going to be sexy. It just has to work.
Just be effective. You know, if it comes down to what your goals are. I mean, if you're out there to, you know, look good and be sexy, then, you know, hey, maybe you don't really want to win. And
yeah,
maybe defeating Nazi zombies isn't your thing.
Well, one of the things that really pisses me off about, you know, a lot of these guys that I talk to is, you know, hey, they're focused on their $1,800 AR-15 with, you know, all kinds of gadgets and shit on it. You know, and that's their focus. They've got a great weapon, and they've got 10,000 rounds of ammunition. Hey, I got these. I got, you know, I can kill a whole lot of zombie Nazis. No, man, the enemy is going to wind up with an $1,800 weapon after they kill you. That's all that's going to happen. A lot of people are really focused on the sexiness. They're really not focused on actually what it takes to defeat the enemy. To me, it just seems like a lot of people watch a whole lot of Rambo and Red Dawn, man.
Well, you know, I got a question for you now. You know, in Rambo and Red Dawn, you know, they never really planned out anything. You know, let's talk about some of this planning that, you know, needs to go on if you're going to be fighting these zombie, you know, these super ninja robot zombie Nazis. Can you just go on and off? Can you just say, hey, look, we want to go hit this place and just kind of say, well, I know this road over here. You know, draw out a little hand-drawn map and go do it? Is that effective?
It is effective if you know the terrain. If you have if someone in your group knows where the roads are, you know, you definitely don't want to wind up going into a dead end trying to get away from the enemy. You have to know the terrain. You have to know the area. Yes, you can go in there and just do an impromptu raid, but you still have to know the area enough to be able to get away. If you are confident that the enemy isn't going to chase you, then go right ahead. But it's all going to depend on the situation, and it's also going to depend on your enemy. Some enemies are really aggressive. Some are just, you know, they just want to get this over with and go back home. That's, you know, it's really just going to depend on the enemy. Not every zombie Nazi wants to fight to the death. Some of them just want to get the hell out of here.
You know, they got little zombie wives and kids at home too, so you know they just want to go home.
Exactly. Yeah. Impromptu raids are.
Now, what about recon? You talked about, you know, reconning and scoping the area. Now, let's assume that you're not going to know everywhere there is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, reconning and, you know, really knowing the area, you know, how long would, you know, given area, I mean, how long, like, let's say, I don't know, like you were, you know, forget about the Nazi zombies, like when you were in Afghanistan or Iraq and stuff, how much recon went into a mission before the mission was actually engaged upon? And, you know, how much information, what kind of information did you need to know about a target before you went in?
Wow. Actually, a lot of information did go into it. The way it was supposed to work was they dropped us off, us being scouts. They would drop us off, and we would observe the enemy, find out what the enemy's strength is. Then we would inform headquarters, and the headquarters would send in the infantry to actually do all the running and gunning. Then actually we would stay there after the battle was over, and then we would inform headquarters what the enemy did afterwards. When you'd be surprised, a lot of the times what was scored as a successful mission actually never really did shit. Only because the enemy had prepared so well beforehand, that they, you know, that they denied us whatever it is that we were trying to hit. But as far as how much recon goes into a mission, I would say never limit yourself. Get as much information as you possibly can. A mission could, like for example, let's say I want to hit zombie headquarters, okay? That might be a mission that we would do 6 months from now, because I want to get as much recon as I can, get a group of people that I'm going to be, that I can work with, and then train on that mission over and over again until we can get it right. It may take, you know, like I said, it may be 6 months down the road, it may be 8 or 8 months or a year down the road.
Depending on the operation and the complexity of it.
Exactly.
I'm sure going after, you know, the Reich Field Marshal for the zombie Nazis is going to take a lot more planning than, you know, hitting a supply depot, let's say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. But even that supply depot would still take a lot of rehearsal and, you know, and it would take a lot of information.
Okay.
Because you would never want your forces to get decimated hitting something, you know, as easy as a power station or something like that because of lack of information. Because, you know, you didn't have anybody telling you that as you were launching your attack, there was a, you know, a freaking battalion that just happened to be coming down the road. Information is the most important thing in a battle. I would just have to say, never limit yourself with how much information you can gather from the enemy.
Okay, also, I got a question for you. Somebody had asked this in the chat room. Now, these zombie Nazis, you know, they're going to be, you know, a lot of the, you know, their vision might not be so great at night, so I'm assuming that they might be using thermal imaging. What kind of thermal imaging equipment is out there currently today? I mean, should this be a concern for us if we're having to fight against them?
It's a very big concern. I've used thermal imaging, you know, that you can mount on weapons. I know helicopters have very good thermal imaging. Even the new armored vehicles, the MRAPs, the drivers are equipped with thermal imaging. And even if the gunner doesn't have a thermal sight on his weapon, the driver can call out, you know, can see where the rounds are going, and he can walk the gunner in. That is a very big concern. And I am not saying that we're not going to lose a lot of people due to the enemy's advanced technology. I mean, if you really think about it, the Vietnamese lost 10 times more than we did but they still won. Only because they had superior techniques and tenacity. That right there is going to be our, that has to be our strength. We, the American people, are the most well-armed force in the world. We would outnumber just about every army that would try to invade us. The problem is that invading army would have way more advanced technology than we have access to. We need to use our numbers and needs to use our tenacity and superior techniques to defeat these zombie Nazis.
There's something else to consider with that, though. They're coming at us with advanced technology. They're also trained and expecting, you know, certain kinds of weapons and technology. If we were to start coming at them with very unconventional things that they haven't seen in a very long time or aren't trained for, you're definitely going to be able to keep them off balance. Like you were saying before, the ballista, you know, flamethrowers, you know, the things that just aren't quite typical battlefield implements. You know, you get MacGyver types, A-team types with, you know, duct tape, dental floss, and, you know, a machine shop. You can make all sorts of just really dangerous stuff that's, you know, just completely fabricated from scratch. They're not going to quite know what to do with that.
Absolutely. For example, one of the things that that would be just absolutely awesome is streetlights raining down napalm. You know, hell, I mean, if you've got your streetlights filled with this napalm exploding over the enemy as they come down the street, one, they're not going to be looking up at streetlights. They're going to look for things that look out of the ordinary.
Right.
A streetlight has always been there. It's something that they're going to be expecting. They may not necessarily notice the different color. It's not clear. It's a little bit yellowish, but they may not notice that as they're driving by. The use of a flamethrower would definitely help. Gosh, I lost that other point. There was the use of napalm. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, here we go.
I've lost it.
You lost it? That's too bad. Well, you'll get it back as we go on to the next one, so we can always come back to it, though. But no, you're right. Okay. I mean, keep things in plain, always hide things in plain sight. That's what I never understood about. I grew up in really bad neighborhoods, and I would watch all these people trying to be shady, and they would act shady. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, by you acting shady, you stand out, and people notice things like that. But when you just do things out in the open, you're less likely to stand out at all. Because nobody's looking for it.
Oh, man. Let me give you an example of something we observed. We were watching this this place. We were expecting an IED to be placed in this one area. And how we were explaining that, it's a whole other story. But we knew that this one area was about to get seeded with an IED. We saw this one couple walk up to the crater, or over to the crater. The woman set down a 3x5 card with some rocks taped to the back of it. She marked the crater. That was going to let the next team know that this is the spot that they need to seed. The husband, or at least the man in the couple, started pulling a wire out from his sleeve and started walking away from the crater. Now, this is he was just out in plain sight. He wasn't acting shady or anything. He was just acting like this is, you know, a everyday occurrence. She looked like she was waiting for public transportation. Nothing seemed absolutely out of the ordinary. If you didn't know what these people were doing, you probably would have never noticed it. But I completely agree. Do things in plain sight. Don't act shady. And like I said in my first point, do something that looks completely normal to the enemy, and the enemy will never figure out what you're doing. Let's see here. A Well, I've already touched on rigging parked cars, trash cans, street lights. Hell, actually, anything that looks normal, anything that doesn't look out of the ordinary or out of place. If if you're setting up an ambush, take those objects and turn them lethal. Put an IED inside a trash can. One of the things that would always get us 90% of the time was IEDs stuffed inside culverts. When an armored vehicle, armored vehicles, at least the Humvees we were using, aren't armored underneath. So when a blast comes from below the vehicle, it would basically pancake the Humvee. That's actually why they started using V-shaped hull vehicles, for that very reason. Let's see. Also, even small IEDs, like, for example, let's say that you've got, three or four Molotov cocktails duct taped together with, a half stick of dynamite or some M80s stuffed inside. Something small like that would be great against anti-personnel, but it could also be effective against a vehicle. Like I said earlier, if you can get those tires to catch on fire, or even if it doesn't permanently damage the vehicle, even if you just set the vehicle on fire, you have just done something to the enemy's mindset.
You've taken out their protection, their enforcement, their superiority.
Yeah,
you've taken out a good chunk of
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely, you have. But like, even if you don't damage the vehicle, you've still affected the enemy's mindset. I'd have to say that most of guerrilla warfare is basically just being able to mind fuck the enemy. That's the whole point of it. Get the enemy out of his comfort zone. Get the enemy scared of everything that could be around the next corner. Get the enemy to believe that you are everywhere all at the same time. Get the enemy to believe that there is nothing he can do to defend himself against you. That is the whole point of guerrilla warfare.
You know, there was a great quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. That's not even a quote. It was more of a footnote from his book, The Gulag Archipelago. And he was talking about, in that book, there was the reference at the bottom of it. He says, how we burned at night in the camps. Now, this is off the top of my head, but how we burned at night at the camps thinking, what if? Basically, what if we had done something, anything, when the NKVD were coming at night? What if we had laid up in ambush at the bottom of stairwells and stuff, waiting for them to come in and we had axes and hammers and picks and fireplace pokers or whatever else we had at hand?
Mm-hmm.
And you knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that those you would be fighting, those heads you would be cracking would be cracking of evil men, those who were up to no good. He goes, and what if they actually started fearing coming out at night or during the day? How long would they have continued? Now, I'm not sure how much fear, the super ninja robot zombie or zombie Nazis are going to, have and stuff like that. But you know what? You always have to try. The psychological warfare aspect of it has always been the greatest factor. The enemy that is defeated psychologically first loses. That's it.
Absolutely.
That's it.
Yeah. That's how we lost in Vietnam. Because the enemy was able to defeat us here. And that affected the morale of the soldiers in Vietnam. And that right there, if you can get the enemy to feel hopeless, you've already beaten him. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty much it. And that's how, we talk about, like, in the, like when we're talking about engaging in other countries and we talk about winning their hearts and minds, that's always fine and well. But when you break somebody's psyche, you know, but when you break their mental fortitude and you get them scared and they no longer feel superior, you just won. All I got to do now is push the advantage. But don't push too hard. Always leave your enemy a way out.
Absolutely. But actually, here's the thing. I'm going to have to argue with that one. Yes, you always want to leave an enemy a way out, because if you close them in, they're going to, you know, they're going to fight because they know that there's nothing, you know, they have nothing to lose. So they're going to fight with every single ounce of energy that they have. If you give the enemy a way out, then they're going to fight long enough so they can escape. But that way out doesn't necessarily have to be physical. It doesn't even have to be real. It only has to be perceived by the enemy.
Exactly.
The enemy can see the way out, and all they're doing is running into a second ambush. When they get confronted by that second ambush, their fighting spirit is done, because you have just dashed all of their hopes. And you have, you know, they have basically realized that they've been outfoxed, and that there is, you know, there's going to be that one instant where their fighting spirit is broken, and that's when you put the last nail in the coffin.
Well, you made a great point there. You know, you don't have the way out does not have to be real. It can be a perceived way out, and as long as the human mind, or even possibly even a robot zombie, not, you know, a zombie Nazi, who knows how they think? They, as long as a way out is perceived, they will never assume that, you know, that I have to fight now or die. They will always think that there is that way out. Now, that way out could lead to additional ambushes, additional whatever, you know, whatever it is. But it doesn't always have to be a way out, just a perceived way out. So, yeah, great point there.
Absolutely. Also, the reverse is true, or the opposite is true. You could trick the enemy into thinking that their quarry is over here when you're actually somewhere else. If it only takes a few snipers to convince a platoon, you know, to move in a certain direction, they're either going to move away from the snipers, but more often than not, they're going to attack the snipers. Well, you've just, you know, basically guided guided this platoon into your ambush. So it's not getting the enemy to perceive what you want them to perceive is a key to success in all of this. Again, going back to what I said. Guerrilla warfare is nothing but a mindfuck.
There we go. I mean, that's truly what it is when you get down to it. And, you know, and a lot of it, I think, you know, what people don't understand, and anybody out there, please, you know, look at the game of chess. The game of chess has been around forever, and it's called the game of kings for a reason. This is what was taught. This is how warfare was taught to people. They played chess.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the chessboard, everybody, you know, I've played a lot of chess in my time. And the vast majority of chess players out there, they play their pawns, they play their queen, they play their rooks, they play their bishops. Very few players I've met, you know, the average everyday players, not, you know, like the chess pros, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, the guys that take on True Blue or anything like that, but just your typical chess player. The two pieces of the game that most people play weak is their knights.
Mm-hmm.
Because they move non-linearly. They don't see all the different aspects. And because they can't see it, that therefore those are the guerrilla troops on that chessboard. Learn to play chess. And even if you don't like it, learn to play chess anyway. It'll teach you to think outside of the box. And if you really want to learn to play chess, learn to play those two knights. That will get you in a true guerrilla mindset. You know, it's amazing, with two pawns and two knights, I can control two-thirds of the board.
Yep. It's funny you say that, actually, because I use my knights. Those are my primarily offensive weapons. I love knights.
There you go. See, you and I think alike. Two pawns and two knights, man, and I control the board.
Yep, same here. Mm-hmm. Those have always been my favorite pieces because people always overlook them. And they're thinking totally on the linear basis, and you can always sneak up behind them and fuck them in the ass with those things 100% of the time when you've got, you know, normal, just average chess players. You know, you're going up against a chess master, not so much so, but they're still important.
Yeah, absolutely. We
had a comment in the chat room, which is actually kind of significant here. It says the most important piece is the pawn to the pawn. That's something that is profound, and that's something to keep in mind there. The most important piece on that chessboard is the pawn to the pawn himself.
Yes. And that brings me to an ugly reality of war. Sometimes you have to use pawns. Sometimes you're going to have to sacrifice pieces. One of the things, and I hope none of the guys in my group are listening, because my commander has a name for people like that. They're delivery boys.
Mm-hmm.
These are just, you know, guys that are completely useless for anything else except for driving a car from point A to point B that they don't know is loaded with explosives. Or carrying a box or a backpack that they don't know is going to blow up. You know, these are nasty things that some of us are going to have to actually do to kill as many zombie Nazis as we can. The use of pawns is something that I don't think the average American likes to even think about.
No,
but,
no, we don't like to think about that, but you gotta know, that's chess. Sometimes you have to sacrifice pawns in order to get a bishop or a king.
Yeah.
Or more important pawn in your opponent's defense.
Yeah. And actually that's something that Sun Tzu says. Sometimes you have to sacrifice something small to gain something large.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's cruel to even think about it, but it's something that, you know, it's one of those things you need to put in your toolbox, and hopefully you'll never have to use, but it's, you know, you might want to keep it around just in case if you do.
Now, here's another strategy in chess, though, that I always play by. I don't care if you're taking my pawn or what. Mm-hmm. If you go after any of my pieces, you will pay dearly to get it. You might take it, but you're going to pay dearly for getting it.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have your defenses. You kept talking about those various things, you know, moving from one position to a more secured position.
Yeah.
To a more secured position. So, you know, you might take my one pawn, but you're going to lose other things in the process as well, and I'll come out, and hopefully you come out ahead in that process. Otherwise, you know, you might want to rethink your chess game.
Well, I mean, that what you do there is you make every one of their gains so costly that they're going to think twice to even, you know, take another step forward.
No, I agree. You know,
yeah.
You know, anything you lose, make them pay dearly for it.
Yeah, but also the opposite is true. Sometimes you want the enemy to get overconfident. Sacrifice a cachet, sacrifice several things. Let them feel that they're invincible. You know, let them think that they're superior to you in every way. And they'll drop their guard, and that's when you attack. Every technique has its opposite that works just as well.
True. Well, like Sun Tzu said, you had brought up that point earlier that Sun Tzu said, you know, if you attack the right, you know, if you attack the right, you know, if you attack the right flank, the left flank has to weaken to strengthen that right flank. If you attack the rear, the front has to weaken to reinforce the right, or to reinforce the rear, so forth and so on. It just keeps going back to that. For every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. You know, and just because A might not work in this scenario doesn't mean that, you know, that that option doesn't work somewhere else.
Very true. By the way, I just remembered what it was that I had forgotten earlier. Improvised booby traps. There now, okay. Everybody can afford a box of 22s. Okay, well, let's say that you can buy, hell, you've got yourself a hundred rounds of 22. You realize that you now just bought yourself a box of 100 landmines, little toe poppers. Okay? One of the things that I believe everyone should do is every time you set up a fighting position, set up a fighting position for your enemy. Something that would entice them to go there. Like, let's say that there's a big rock in front of this house that you're going to be shooting from. Well, you know, or a wall or something, or a cluster of trees. You know that the enemy is going to say, hey, man, that is some great cover and concealment right there. I am running right there. Well, guess what? That whole area is mined with these little 22s, okay? All it takes is one of those to take out an enemy. It doesn't have to kill him. It just has to wound him. And once he's wounded, he's out of the fight. If you can set up this basically every one of your areas, you fall back, your enemy moved to where you were. Well, he just wound up in another damn land, you know, hitting another bunch of landmines. He's going to think twice about chasing you the next time he encounters you. You know, you can do a lot of damage with a little 22. Imagine what you can do with a 12 gauge. There's a lot of simple ways that you can rig a round to act as a landmine.
Shotgun buckshot as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And a lot of those specialty shotgun shells as well, like the Sergeant Slaughter's, the Shredder's, the Dragon's Breath, all those good things.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm not even going to mention that one. Never mind. But it's... A dragon's breath round works really well to propel and ignite napalm.
Mm-hmm.
That's about as far as I'm going to go with that one. Everyone always says, you know, simple things like, hell, you know, I'm going to shoot and scoot or hit and run I'm just going to improvise, you know, some booby traps. Well, dude, that's just a bunch of bullshit, man. Unless you're actually, you know, designing these things, testing these things, you know, it's all just a bunch of talking bullshit. If you're not training on where to run to after you hit, or training what to hit in the first place, or you're not practicing, how to design and build these improvised booby traps, you know, it's just a bunch of bullshit, really.
Well, you're not going to know how to do it. I mean, it's kind of like going, you know, saying, I'm going to go learn how to camp. I'm going to go learn how to do it, you know, survive in the woods on my own with nothing but a knife and a blanket. Well, good luck with that. That's not the time to learn, is when you're out there. You have to learn how to do that stuff beforehand. You don't learn anything on the fly. You never learn anything on the fly.
No. And, hell, I mean, trying to figure out a way to get around, turn into a landmine or a booby trap as you're being chased by the enemy is not the right time to do it. By the way, I just remembered another thing. You had asked me about thermal imaging.
Yes, thermal imaging. Let's go back to that.
Yeah. One of the ways to fool thermal imaging is to put a layer between you and the imaging device. Something as simple as a one of those thermal reflexive blankets, like a survival blanket. It's green on one side and
right,
reflective on the other. Okay, as long as your body is not touching that blanket, you are completely invisible to thermal imaging.
Now, I've got a question. Somebody was just in the chat room asking that a minute ago, and we've got several, you know, operators that are in the room, you know, ex-operators or operators that are in the room now. Uh-huh. And one of them has mentioned that those thermal blankets will not hide enough of your body heat. You will be noticed.
No. No, it won't. If you wrap yourself up with that blanket, it's not going to work. But let's say that you dig a hole.
Right.
Okay. And then you cover the top of the hole with that blanket.
Ah.
That will work.
Okay, so your body is not touching absolutely. It, therefore it's not absorbing the heat, therefore it's not reflecting it back out.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
Use it as a cover, like a tarp or something like that, but not actually touching you.
That's right.
I would also propose decoys, you know, being able to make your own heat sources that look like they're, you know, the enemy to them, that they go after them. You know, when you're safely, you know, hidden in your hole with a thermal blanket over you, you know, they're going after the exact wrong thing. You can turn the enemy's assets to liabilities.
Exactly right. For example, let's say that you've got, you know, the enemy is following you. Well, it goes back to area prep. Like I said earlier, it's just not sexy, and sometimes it takes a shovel. Before the mission, you dug yourself a hole. You've covered it up with this tarp. You jump under there. The zombie Nazi helicopter is looking for you. Well, inside, you know, this bush, several hundred meters away, there's a bunch of hand warmers inside this large cluster of bushes or whatever. Well, the enemy is now looking at that, thinking it's you.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely, you're absolutely right. You can take you can turn the enemy's technology against them, and all they're going to do is looking at ghosts, you know, or looking for ghosts, basically. Now, let's say that you have a force ambush right, or you know, all of them are inside their little holes. The patrol goes out looking for this one, you know, bush with hand warmers, nothing but hand warmers in there. Well, they've just walked into another ambush.
Right, exactly. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had a question in there. Somebody was asking a question. I think I saw something in there about the 22 mines.
Okay.
I think it is. How would you go about constructing a 22 mine?
Huh.
I don't know. Do we really want to go into that?
I'm thinking no.
I think as yeah. Yeah, I think
the point is that you need to learn how to do that stuff for yourself. Those are the kinds of things that you would want to educate yourself on.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Put a little imagination to it. It's really not that. I mean, think about what it takes inside a gun to make that round go off and then apply that to a booby trap. It's really not that hard to figure it out.
There was somebody that just mentioned in the chat room about using portable stoves as a dummy heat signature. That's out of the box thinking.
It is. It absolutely is. The problem with that, though, and I mean, you can figure it out, you know, work it to get it to work right. But the thermal imagers can tell the heat intensity.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You're right. You're right.
Yeah, and open flame is just what you know. That is a really, really bright spot, and you can tell that is not a person. Hand warmers, though, you know, you let's say you take the hand warmers and you put them under another tarp, you know, below some bushes. Believe it or not, plant life actually gives off heat. So the you know the moving leaves kind of help disguise. The shape of a of whatever it is that's hiding behind it, but you can still see it. You know, I mean, you can still see an outline, but you can't see it clearly, and you wouldn't be able to see a three-dimensional shape. You know, so if you have these hand warmers out in the shape of someone laying down on the ground from above. It looks like a person down there, especially if that helicopter is off at some distance. You know, the same thing would be it wouldn't be the same for ground-based thermal imaging units, but you know, take some clothes, make like a freaking scarecrow and stuff it with hand warmers or some kind of heat source. Get creative. But definitely, you know, hell, do whatever you can to fool the enemy into thinking that you're in one place when you're actually somewhere else.
You could fill up a blow-up doll with hot water.
No. That is out-of-the-box thinking.
Nice. Okay, there we go. We got the blow-up dolls with hot water. Nice. Very well.
In fact, yeah. In fact, I'm actually going to go out and buy a blow-up doll for that very reason now.
Very cool. There you go. Well, we are down to our last 8 minutes. And, you know, I want to say that I've enjoyed this show. I really have. I wasn't too sure how this was going to go out. I was actually kind of nervous about, you know, really looking at this and going into it. But I think over the last couple of weeks, you know, I think we put together a pretty good idea and a good basis for where this Gorilla in the Mist show can go.
Okay.
So in the last 8 minutes, close us out. We're down to our last eight, so close us out here.
Okay. I would like to finish off by saying that a lot of people think they know what guerrilla warfare is. But basically all they know are just cliches or, you know, tired out, used up techniques that every single zombie Nazi has seen in every single movie that they've ever seen before and already knows by heart. It takes a group of people to talk out techniques, talk out scenarios, talk out situations to figure out the best way to attack zombie Nazis, really come up with new and fresh ideas, any ways to think out of the box. I would have to say that the best way to do that is to first research what the Viet Cong did. You know, use them for inspiration. Take their ideas and then use that and transfer it to modern day uses. A lot of the ideas I got was just reading accounts from from booby traps and stuff or things that the soldiers in Vietnam ran into. Combine that with my personal experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I found out that these guys are using the same tricks that they used in Vietnam. And guess what, man? Some of those techniques, yes, we already know about, but damn it, they still work.
You know, they were famous for the Vietnamese were famous for one particular one, injuring somebody in the group. When you injure somebody in the group, you take out another two or three. You know, you take out at least another two guys along with the one that you injured.
Yes, that we found out that only works with Americans. If we injure a Mujahideen in Afghanistan, no one else in the group really gives a fuck about him.
Really?
Sucks to be them. Absolutely.
Sucks to be them.
We have, you know, I mean, the rounds we shoot aren't necessarily designed to kill. They're designed to injure. Well, the Mujahideen really don't give a fuck about getting hurt. Their intent is to die.
Right.
If you shot them in the arm or in the leg and they can still shoot, hell, they're happy as hell. You know, they really are happy as hell. And their buddies are not going to go in there to rescue them. So that, like I said, that technique works against Americans. It doesn't always work against anybody else. I couldn't tell you, how well it'll work against, super ninja robot zombie Nazis.
Well, I mean, they're zombies, man. What are they really going to care about each other? Who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
You know, maybe one day we'll find out, you know,
Absolutely.
Test the theory and find out, and then we can share it with others. Hey. You know, you take out the legs and it doesn't work. They don't care. They just keep coming at you.
Yeah, then you know. Then you know that you can't use the 22 landmines anymore. You've got to go up to, some buckshot.
You need to go to some buckshot or some Sergeant Slaughter or incendiary, you know, some of those dragon's breath ones. Something better.
Or bolo rounds. Now, tell me that a tripwire ambush set up with a bolo round wouldn't be nasty. Have you ever seen those?
No, I've never. What is that?
Okay, it's two double odd buck.
Oh, yeah.
Cano,
Yeah, the Sergeant Slaughters. Yeah, the piano wire.
Yeah, it's got piano wire.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the Sergeant Slaughters, those were called. I don't know what they're called. Now I know back in the 80s, early 90s, those were called Sergeant Slaughters. They were nasty.
I see.
Yeah, two big buckshot men with a piano wire in between them.
It will cut the person's leg off.
Yep.
Or legs off. Yeah, and you've got both. You've got one injured guy that's definitely about to die.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. Those are nasty. It all comes down to just using what you have on hand the most effectively. You know, it's not necessarily going to be any one particular set of things that you're going to be using. It depends on what you have on hand, what the circumstances are, and how much time you've got to play around. You've just got to get in. It's a mindset more than anything. You got to get in the mindset of using your tools and assets in an out of the box way that your enemy cannot possibly foresee.
Exactly, but you've just touched on a very important point. Use the time you have. Right now, we have a lot of time, and we have access to almost anything that we want. Practice. Get off your ass and do something. Start thinking out of the box now. Start training out of the box now. Start getting your plans. Start preparing. Start getting ready. Collect what you can, and then learn how to use that. Cross train with different weapons. Learn what you can about improvised booby traps, and then practice that in a safe manner. But it takes a whole lot of hard work for you to get something right, for you to actually do it in the battlefield. My master always told me, tears in a dojo means a lot of less blood in a fight.
There's a guy out there who some of you might know him on from various boards and stuff. He goes by the name Tire Iron. This guy is one of those guys who's been who's been lifelong special forces, and now he's a private contractor. He's in places where he can't tell you because it's top secret, and he can't tell you anything.
Okay.
He told me one time. He told me, he's got a saying that he's posted a few times. An amateur practices until he gets it right. A professional practices until he can't get it wrong.
That's such an important thing to keep in mind, and also remember, just about anything can be weaponized. A bag of flour can be used to make a formidable fuel air explosion.
Don't limit
yourself.
All right, well, listen, everybody.
But yes, absolutely. A bag of flour, a can of gasoline, and some small explosives, and you can blow up a house.
All right, well, listen, everybody. We're coming up now to the close of this show. Cav, wonderful job. I really appreciate you having it coming on with us and really suggesting something. We start this series, so... And I want to thank you for being the first one on here. I want to thank you for laying a wonderful foundation for us to keep building upon. And we're going to get you back on here soon. So thank you.
Okay.
Really appreciate it. And if anybody wants to get in touch with Cav, if you want to throw your email out there, if not, you can drop a line to me and I can forward his info and I can forward your questions on to him. Or you can find him. I'm pretty sure you're on some of the other militia boards as well, correct?
Well, I'm primarily on RAM, but I still stop in by the American Resistance Movement from time to time.
All right. Well, there you go. He's on RAM now. So that's the close of this show. Now, tomorrow we've got the East Washington 63rd Brigade or Battalion coming on. Brigade, I forgot which one they are. East Washington 63rd. Ed LeStage. This guy is incredible. I've enjoyed every conversation I've had with him immensely. Next week, we're also going to have on... Monday, we're going to have on Smiter, who's going to continue the Gorilla in the Mist series with us. Smiter's a long-time naval spec ops guy, and we're going to be delving more into this. So that'll be next Monday, and to be honest with you, I forgot who's coming on Sunday. My brain is kind of lost this week. I've been... really pushing stuff around on this one. So I appreciate everybody out there. And again, please keep in mind, I'm not really promoting or marketing the show anymore. So the ideas that we're presenting, the plans that we talk about, the committees of safety, all of these ideas that our founders left us, if you would like to see more people engaging upon them, you need to make that happen and help get the word out there. The more people that we have thinking along the same lines and understanding what that Founding Fathers plan was and how we can use it today in exactly the same way they did it, and we actually have a show out here that's discussing things like this one, like this show that we just had, instead of talking about the typical everyday garbage that we talk about, the talking about the events. You know, we know that the world is crap right now. We get it. Now the question is, are we going to keep talking about that, or are we going to keep talking about what are we going to do? This show's about what we're going to do. So, up to you guys. You know, help make the show grow. Help get people thinking about it. Bring your friends on. A couple people have gotten upset because they're not getting my emails about the show. Again, if you are not getting my emails and you were on my old email list, that email list is gone. You need to email me again, randymack@youhavetreadonme.com. Put subscribe me in the header and I will add you to the new email list. Otherwise, you're going to continue not getting the emails. And that's about it. You know, I forgot who's coming on next Sunday. Damn, I'm terrible. I am just completely and utterly crap now. But anyways, everybody, you guys be safe out there. Be free. Keep thinking outside of the box, and you got to ask yourself, just like Cabscale said, what are you doing today?
Absolutely.
You know, if you didn't do anything yesterday, what are you doing today? And if you didn't do anything today, when are you going to start doing something?
Get off your ass.
Get off your ass. Do something out there. Make it happen. Make it happen. It's only going to happen with you. So, everybody be safe, be free. We're done for the night. Take care. See you tomorrow.